Okay, so this class is on teaching middle grade English. How many of you are teaching middle grade English, meaning grades 4 to 6, somewhere in there? All right. Most of my English classes were above that. I did teach down to grade 5, taught grade 6 a number of years. English for me as a scholar was one of those students that I stayed as far away from as I could. Had I spent as much time figuring out how to actually do the lesson as I spent figuring out how not to do it, I'd have been stellar. But I was, alas, not stellar. Thank you.
That's not very reasonable.
It'll work.
Okay.
Thank you. So my first year of teaching, my daily routine was, as soon as school was over, I studied language class 90 miles an hour, gusts up to 200, which I had to do because my survival depended on it. I was teaching grades 7, 8, 9, and 10, right? So I had no small job on my hands, right? But 1 year of teaching under that kind of situation, by the second year, I had to study probably 25% as long. And of the 16 years that I taught school, one of the books, The Rod and Staff, Pink One, the 8th grade book, I taught every single year that I taught school. And that book, today yet, I believe I could flip open any lesson, even the ones on retained objects and indirect objects, and I could teach that lesson at the snap of a finger. That's what happens. I give that by way of encouragement, not to say that look at me, I'm saying look at what you can do. Right? You can get to that point. Keep notes in the books. Keep your own set of teacher's guides, and it will happen as you teach that every consecutive year, it's kind of like, oh yeah, I remember this lesson. Literally, you will remember that lesson, especially if you have some notes in there to just spur you on. All right, so I'm getting ahead of myself. I'd like to explain briefly what I'm going to do with this class. I'd like to give you some general tips for teaching language. Some of these tips apply to anything you teach, and some of them are very specific to language. The first segment of this class is going to be some tips for teaching middle grade language. English, in our case, not French. Right. Secondly, what we're going to do is we're going to get these chairs populated with some boys, with some willing students, and I'm actually going to conduct a class. Right. Then, the third and final segment of the class is they're going to go out, and it's your turn. Right. You ask questions, you poke holes, kindly, gently. Tell me where I should have done something different, what you intend to do different. Why did you thus and so, right? The slice and dice session, right? So without further ado, we're going to go on into some points for teaching language. And no, I do not have a handout. I know you've become so accustomed to getting handouts that you're thinking ill of me right now for not giving you one. Let me change that. I believe that you are intelligent individuals capable of taking your own notes. Tip number one. Right, so number one, to study language is to study its laws. Very simple statement, perhaps obvious. But if you're going to know how to pronounce something in English, you need to know the laws that govern pronunciation. If you're going to know how to say something in Rohingya, a language my son is studying right now, since he's in Bangladesh working with the Rohingya people, he's going to have to know the laws that govern that language. So studying and teaching language is really teaching law. It's teaching rules. And you can't change that. That's inherent with the study. It's how to arrange a sequence of things, syntax we call it. How to choose between she and her, nominative objective case. Gender, mechanics, punctuation. All these things are governed by laws. And study the law. You are going to become a lawyer to teach language well. That's what it becomes. Tip number two. Sometimes a rule seems senseless and arbitrary. All right? Get over it. Okay? You simply, as I tell my students frequently, you were not bored enough to influence this stuff. Right? And you're going to just have to simply live with it. Right? Had you been born when the English language was being formed, then you could have perhaps influenced it, right? But now we just have to live with the laws that are put in place. And so you can kick against them. You can say they're crazy. You can say in a more civil form, they're very arbitrary. Or you can just say, as students would do, duh, all right? Take your pick. The bottom line is get over it, all right? That's a tip for teaching English. Many things in life are this way, actually, when you stop and think about it. Horse, the word horse, as in, right, galloping horses. What about H-O-R-S-C has to do with horse? Nothing. But it works. And we may as well get used to it. So it is with nominative and objective case. So it is with direct objects and indirect objects. It's the way it is. And so we just accept it and we go from there. Right? Tip number three. In teaching language, terms are priceless. Know the terms. Okay? Much of language, a study of any language, I would suppose, has to do with the terms, right? So, how would you rather teach English? Well, put this thing here and that thing there, and then this thingy goes up on the turkey foot-like thingy, contraption-like, and or would you rather say, we put the subject first? I'm obviously talking about diagramming here, right? You put the subject first, and then you have a vertical line extending equally above and below the baseline, and the verb goes here, followed by a direct object. See the difference, right? If your students and if you know with clarity what subject and verb and predicate noun or predicate nominative, you know what those things mean and drill them on that set of law, why, you're 80% of the way to understanding language. This is the way it is with many things. For instance, if one of my other fields of knowledge lies with electrical work. And so electricians say things like this. 12.2 Romex is good for 20 amps, except that the deregulation law goes to 16 amps. Did that sound like something that's real useful and you had a context for? Well, likely not, because you weren't pulling 12.2 Romex. The other day I saw something really cool, by the way. It was 12.4 Romex, right? The terms is what I'm illustrating, see? Electricians know what amps and volts and watts and Romex and MC, they know what those things stand for, okay? So it is with English. We have to know the terms, use the terms, drill the terms, and you're halfway home. But it's words like this, demonstrative. Well, not in lower grade language, all right? Not in middle grade language, but maybe nominative, maybe. See, adjectives come, you say some things are concrete, right? By the way, know how to pronounce them too. If you're using the word that looks like concrete as an adjective, you say it concrete, not concrete, right? No, use it, use the terms and say them correctly. Here's an actual radio transmission from an ambulance en route to a hospital. This is the way it sounded, microphone here. Inbound with a 10-year-old male with an anterior laceration to the cranium. Had some particular language, right? And the reason I'm able to tell you this story is because that transmission was a student who was transporting his very first patient into the hospital, and he knew that his teacher was on duty in the ER. All right? So he was going to jolly well get this right. And another reason he remembers it is when he got there, his teacher looked down at the 10-year-old with an anterior laceration on his cranium and said, "What happened, Sonny? Did you bop your gourd?" We're talking about using correct terms, right? We ought to be using correct terms. All right, tip number four. I just simply use this. Right, use diagrams. Diagrams are an awesome visual aid for teaching English. I had a public school teacher tell me, this public school teacher was old enough to be my dad. I had the delightful privilege of going out to breakfast with him once a month for years. But he said when their curriculum removed diagramming from English, by the way, he taught third grade. He said when our curriculum removed diagramming from English, I can no longer teach English. Right? And I believe that's about where we ought to come to in our teaching too. When we're talking about subjects and verbs, you can be putting S in here and DO here, or you can go like that, and you can put PN for predicate nominative, or PA for predicate adjective, and so on. And you can talk about the adjectives being under here, and it goes on and on, right? Diagrams ought to be part of your native air when in the language, teaching language mode. Use diagrams, because what happens is students actually begin to think in terms of the visual. So when you're talking about, you're introducing the idea of a predicate nominative, which I think in younger grades are probably going to call a predicate noun, right? They're actually going to think about, oh, a predicate noun, this is what will come up in their head here, right? Rooster tail, right? Okay, they're going to actually think subject, verb, predicate nominative, okay? If you've been doing this, if you've been doing your job of feeding them the visual, they will think in that visual. Otherwise, predicate nominative becomes a bean in a boxcar that just bounces around and has no real attachment point, right? So use diagrams. They're a great visual aid. Number five. The prereqs, prerequisites. Every lesson depends on some previous knowledge. Identify the prerequisites for this lesson, okay? So what I'm going to do, sneak preview, these students right here are going to come in and they're going to have a lesson on direct objects. Before I can teach them much about direct objects, I have to identify what are the prerequisites on what does that knowledge rest? Well, it rests on a good understanding of this right here, right? If I'm going to talk about a direct object, that whole term, direct object, the term carries a considerable amount of freight, right? In this case, the freight that it carries is that it is a direct object, it is a receiver of the action verb. And I have to have this in place before I can get that in place, right? So your teaching will be effective as you identify the prereqs. What are the prerequisites? What is the basis of knowledge on which this new knowledge hangs? And that's really low-hanging fruit, folks. If you studied at all the art of teaching, you know that the unknown must be explained in terms of the known, right? It becomes a launching pad for the next step, right? We can only step from where we have been and where we are, right? So the prereqs. And tip number six and last is read first. Require the students to read the lesson first. I think this actually applies to practically anything that you teach, but many of us who are in a classroom setting rather than a self-led experience or individualized, as it's sometimes called, many of us teachers think that we're only doing our job if we explain the lesson thoroughly, and whether or not the student reads the lesson is inconsequential. I would like to say that that's a problem. We have to get our students to read the lesson before we teach it. Because what will happen is students are just as busy as you are, right? They have things to do. They have places to go. They have goals for their day, right? So they're looking for shortcuts just like the rest of us, all right? And one of the shortcuts that's very easy for them to identify is if the teacher always explains the lesson wonderfully and serves it up on a nice silver platter, there's no need for them to read the lesson at all. And so they won't. Are the students reading the lessons in your classrooms? If they aren't, why then it would have made the curriculum providers, speaking now from Christian Life's perspective, they're working way too hard writing all this stuff for the students, right? The students must read the lesson. So what I did, I'm just about to call those students in, is I gave them the lesson and I told them, I said, you go into that room over here and you read it and do as much as you can, right? Because that's the way I approach, especially skills-based lessons, math lessons, English lessons. I refuse to teach either one of those if even one student didn't read the lesson, okay? Call me an old ogre, call me a crotchety old teacher. That's okay, because I'm just honoring one of the other laws of teaching, and that is you should not tell a student something that they could know themselves without you telling them. Because teaching is creating in the student's mind what they need to know, the student creating in their own mind. The learner is one who learns a lesson in their own mind. Conception, concept, that happens internally, right? So we got to honor that somehow. And I found that this is a great way to honor that. Have the students read the lesson before the lesson begins, right? Any questions before we call in the students? Any comments? Yes?
So what about those students that then know what to do? Like they say they know how to do it, do you require them then to listen in on class? on the explanation?
I do. Right? Now, what if it's all of them? Well, then I'm off the hook. If a student can demonstrate, if the entire group of students in that grade can demonstrate that they know how to do the lesson, I don't need to be a teacher. They don't need me as a teacher. They need me as a manager, and that's it. That's the way I would feel about it. Great question. Is there more?
Well, there are some students that can read the lesson, but it's meaningless to them until I can say it.
And then that person needs a teacher. Right, there is going to be that range. You're exactly right. There is going to be that range of ability, right? And that, then they need you. But they can still try to read the lesson. I would probably contend that if there's a student that can't read the lesson on their own at all, we're talking about middle grade context, probably something went wrong back there that should have been addressed, right, if they're unable to read the lesson. Because after all, the lesson I'm going to teach comes from a book that says 502. That first number is pretty important. And occasionally you need to point at that number to your student and say, hey, you know, is this the right number for you? Right. And usually that perks them up a little bit. you can do so with tact, right? All the things that were said in that first address. I'm not sure why we just didn't stop our day and do like the Quakers do and just sit around and meditate. It would have actually been an appropriate response. More question or comment?
So sometimes, if it seems like a fairly simple lesson, I'll just say, if you have questions, come up for class.
I think you're a teacher. If that works in your classroom, that's awesome and tremendous. I wouldn't want to tamper with it. Continue. Right? If the students are able to learn on their own, wonderful. Let it be said of our students, they've learned how to learn, and that is sufficient. Who said that? Plato or the Apostle Paul or Aristotle? Or I don't know, maybe Jonah Levine, I'm not sure. Would you please go call those boys in? Down the hall, last door on the right.
Oh, that's what they were doing.
Tell them we're ready. And by the way, that's the kind of exchange I want to have after we dismiss them. Okay? So I feel a little bit twitchy right now because I just told you how to do it. And so we're going to take care of some of that. But
you already wrote it down.
I already wrote it down, yeah. But look, be watching, okay? And tell me what you didn't see after the session, right? We're going to have a slice and dice, and this is not about me. It's about you. It's about all of us together learning how we can be more effective teachers, right? Welcome. Right here is where we have chairs for you. Jackson. If I say George, that means Jackson. And Trevor. Okay. And if I say Bill, that means Trevor. Okay. So today we're going to have a language class, English class. Did you read your lesson? You read it? So it made sense? Thumbs up if it made sense. Thumbs sideways if it sort of kind of didn't. Thumbs down if it made no sense whatsoever. All right. So where are we? Okay. So we have three thumbs sideways today and one that's okay, that's good, that's okay. You know, you always ought to try something, right? Like we always do, we want to try. I mean, we don't just want to lay there like a blob and let life go by, right? We'll be trying. Good. Well, look, I'm really glad that you read the lesson. So the lesson today is about what, Alex?
Direct objects.
Direct objects, right? Right? Did you figure that out too, Billy? Good. All right. So when we're talking about direct objects, let's put the diagram up here. What is it that goes at this position on the diagram?
Subject.
The subject goes right here. Good job. And what is a subject? Anybody? Yes?
The thing that the sentence is talking about.
That's right. The thing that the sentence is talking about. All right. Let's put a sentence up here. Let's say, Bill kicked the ball. All right. So in this sentence, what word should I single underline because it's a subject? Yeah, because that is just exactly what George said about what... I wish you had a name tag. I'm so sorry. I'm really bad with names unless I have name tags or I know you better. But anyway, that's what the sentence is about, right? It's about Bill, and that's what a subject is. The subject is the thing that a sentence is about. That's a good working definition
for a subject. Good job. All right, what goes right here on our diagram?
A verb.
A verb, that's right. And when sometimes we call that the predicate, but maybe I'm not sure if you, where you are in your studies, did you hear that called predicate? You did. Right? Did you hear it called a predicate before? I don't know. It's life is strange. When you get order, we use big words to mean the same thing. Why not just call it a verb, right? Right. What's a verb? What's the definition of a verb?
A word that shows action or being.
Well, that's right. It's a word that shows action or being. That's not the definition necessarily, but you're real close. Yes.
What the subject did.
All right. I should have said, what's the definition that talks about what the function of a verb is? Yeah. It's what the subject did or is. So here, what in this sentence, what is the verb? Tell me, anybody, together?
Kicked.
That's right. All right. So here, Bill kicked, Bill did something, right? And the verb is what he did. Now, of course, we can have action verbs, and we can have being verbs. The being verbs, can you say them with me? With me. Am, is, are, was, were, be, been, being, all right? That's enough for today. But kicked is an action verb. You can see that happening. Kick, right? And here it says what he kicked. And this word right here is the direct object. I'm just going to put D-O for direct object, right? The direct object is the thing that directly receives the action. Right? The word that follows an action verb. Bill kicked the ball. Right? So right here is our direct object. Is this anything like what's on your paper? Because I don't have my book. Right? Yeah, you see it? See how it's doing that? And it tells you in your lesson today that if you have a being verb, right, you cannot have Bill is and followed by a direct object because Bill is not the ball, Bill is not the cat, and so on. Right? It has to be an action verb, right? So finding the direct object is really not that difficult at all. I would suggest you do this in your head. Let's see. Let's draw head, right? Rooster tail. All right, this is what you should be thinking in your head. Now let's put some hair in the middle, too. There we go. Okay, you should be thinking something like this, right? Subject. Next is, say it together. Verb, and then
direct object.
Good. Right now, I forgot, folks. I'm sorry. Just hang tight. I have some lessons here. There's not enough for everybody. But just hang them around a little bit. Right? I wanted you to be able to see what they're seeing. Okay? So it's not rocket science. All right. Did you try the lesson? Did you try the lesson? How did it work out? Is that where this comes in? I thought maybe. Right. But so far, up to this point, are we thumbs up on this? We're thumbs up? It's not thumbs down. Okay, it's thumbs up. Very good. Let's look at number one there on the second page. Do you see the one that says Lorraine read her new book on the long trip? Okay, what's the subject? Austin, what's the subject in that sentence?
Book.
No, the subject.
Lorraine.
Lorraine, that's right. And what did the subject do? Lorraine, what's the verb? Read. And what's the direct object?
Book.
That's right. Lorraine read book. Can you see that? I can see it. Okay, let's go to the next sentence. Number two, Daniel and Aaron built what? And right there's a key. What you can do to find a direct object, do you want to have the answers just sort of tumble out of the sky and hit you on the head so that you can write them on the paper? Would that be nice? I thought so too, right? If you want that to happen, all you need to do is you need to say the subject and the verb and then say what. Look at this. Bill kicked what? Now look at on your paper. Number two, Daniel and Aaron built what?
Gazebo.
Is that the direct object? It sure is.
You caught it. Number three, Dad bought what?
Laptop.
All right, well, that was the first part. Now, part B says underline each verb twice and the subject once. Well, my goodness, you've been doing that ever since you were wee tiny tots, right? You've been identifying subjects and verbs, right? Now, the part that's new, though, is this thing, this business of finding the direct object. But all you need to do is once you have the subject underlined once and the verb twice, all you need to do is think just like this guy's thinking. Bill kicked what? There it is. Bingo. Okay? That's how you do part B. Did you do part B? Do you think you did it correctly? Shall we check if you did it correctly? Okay. Grandmother is the what?
Subject.
All right, what's the verb? Yes.
Thanked.
Grandmother thanked what?
Us.
And do you have us labeled as direct object? Yay. Right track. Number two, what's the subject?
Grandpa.
Verb?
Told.
What?
Story.
Do you have a story labeled as a direct object? Well, you did it again. Is this an easy lesson or what? That's what I was thinking too. All right, part C you're going to have to figure out on your own all by yourself. All right, part D. Well, that's not that terribly hard because it already gives you the baseline, the frame, and everything you need. You just have to fill in the blanks, just like we were doing up here, right? Of course, it has some other stuff there too, but you've been doing that other stuff for quite some time now, and you're good to roll. And that's the new lesson. You're done. You ready to roll? Thumbs up, thumbs down, thumbs sideways when you're ready to roll. Now let's just pretend this is real school. And at this point, the teacher would be rushing off to grade 42 or whatever. So you're good to go? Thumbs up? All right, the thumbs are up. Okay, you may be excused. You're ready to go. Thank you for your help, folks. Right, that was fifth grade language class, according to my definition of language class. But what do you have to say about it? Questions, comments? This class closes when?
4:00.
Oh boy, I wasn't going to give you over 15 minutes to flay and splay me, but go for it. Questions or comments? Any stakes you like to pound on, any you like to pull up entirely?
This isn't a flaying or splaying, yeah. But you missed a whole lot of fun you can have in direct object class.
Okay, tell me more.
It's the first language lesson there is, because have someone be the verb and someone be the direct object. Like, it's when they actually get to punch their classmates in class.
Could you do that for us right here? You couldn't. Okay.
But, like, that just gives them, well, I do. I always have objects up there, like Miss Celeste threw the eraser, and you do it.
Uh-huh.
Michael punched Sheldon, and let them do that. And
okay.
Or Michael tugged Emily's pigtail, whatever.
Excellent ideas. Excellent.
So they don't want to stop doing that usually.
Right. What should have happened here is somebody that actually taught a lot more middle grade stuff. I mean, if I tell a seventh grader, if I say to George to punch, you know, Bill, boy.
But, well, I tell him good.
Yeah, of course. No, we understand. Right. Also, one of the things I had on my mind, okay, I don't want to be all defense here, but I did have on my mind that I think that many of us are in multi-grade classrooms, and one of the things that we struggle with is having enough time for classes. So we kind of, I feel like I was working, trying to illustrate that a class does not need to be a long period of time. I wanted to keep it short and boom, here it is, folks. And then we have fun at recess, a lot of fun at recess. But at the same time, you're exactly right. I could have had props in here, right, to make this lesson a whole lot more exciting.
What about review? Would you usually do a review, some review stuff in class?
I did.
Yeah.
Okay, so I didn't necessarily call it review, but I tried. I think I did. Now, it's true that I did not even look at the teacher's guide for this lesson at all in my preparation or anything. So it is true that perhaps I should have had a section of review where we're doing review about information that is not that prerequisite. Good point.
Right. How much of a class should be review?
How much of a class should be review? Right. Well, I would suggest that we're actually doing a good bit more review than what we actually think. Oftentimes, I tend to think of review as just like what he was using, the definition of review. It's kind of like now we're going to have this time when we actually are reviewing things that are not necessarily about the new lesson. Right? Again, it depends on your curriculum. CLE is not paying me to say this, but CLE has a lot of review built in it that the student can lead themselves through. Right, so they're doing a good bit of review already, just inherent with the design of the curriculum. Right, I do believe though that you're getting taught to teach, and so rather than saying, "Well, we're going to let it up to the curriculum to review," and I go sit at my desk, right? If you have time to be reviewing and doing the flashcards for whatever, you can make flashcards for language as well. You ought to be doing that review. Be my feeling. More thought on that? Okay.
What flashcards are there for language?
I should know right off the top of my head. The first thing I would do is go get the CLE catalog and look if there's flashcards available for middle grade language. Can someone answer that?
Reference sheets,
flashcards,
I'm not sure.
Okay, not really. Reference sheets, there are those, I know what you mean, maybe you, the laminated cards, the information on that, if when I say flashcards, it probably in this case it would have to be something you made yourself.
When you say know the terms, should I be making my students memorize the definitions for
I would promote just the idea of, like we had here, a working definition. You know, that you ask them what is a subject and they can approximate the answer, right? That it seems like that would be valuable. That's what it feels like to me, but maybe there's teachers here. What do you think? Are there? Do you have your students memorizing terms? One of the things you'll find in rod and staff curriculum for sure is they will have a matching section somewhere on the test. And they have to know the term matched to an exact script, right? So I feel it's fair to prepare the students for that and use that script in your teaching.
Johnny, I think CLE does some of that, like on their quizzes.
I think there's some of that as well.
It's not quite as catchy, maybe, but there is some of that.
Right.
You said about the diagram thing, and I just want to reinforce that as that is actually legit works. I mean, I use that in language all the time. I've actually had students that, like in CLE language, I know there's several times they have to go through the sentence and label all the parts of speech.
Yes.
As sentence parts or even as part of speech. And I get students that they can diagram perfectly well, but when they actually have to label them individually in a sentence, they get kind of gummed up. And I'll just pull out your paper and diagram it. Before I actually help them, I said, you gotta do that first before I come help you. And without fail, they know exactly what it is because they know where it goes on the diagram.
Right.
And so they can, so I think it's a great tool to use.
Yeah, I think diagram has received a lot of bad rap over the years. And a lot of it, I think, has to do with the fact that teachers aren't using it correctly. That would be my guess. But having said that, I will say that one of my students told me one time that they see no sense whatsoever in diagramming. He was really frustrated. I mean, he was way out, I feel. But so he sees no sense whatsoever in diagramming, except if he were shipwrecked on an island and he was there without water for so many days, and the 40th day he decides to do one more thing. I'm going to diagram one more sentence before I die. And in so doing, it on the sand, he uncovers a spring. Right? Then he can see value in diagram. That's actually true. That's what you get when you work around children. You get stories like that. Well, I have some work to do as a teacher, right? If that's the feedback I'm getting from my students, well, I would like to try to demonstrate that it has more value than just if you're shipwrecked or not.
Well, if there are people here teaching rods, I taught that for a while. I think, too, it can become tiresome because they have 15 of them to do. And I know in those lessons, I'd say, hey, do the first five, we'll do the other rest in class. Or there's ways of shortening it down to where they get to it and it's not such a huge load. Mm-hmm. I think that's why in CLE they actually don't mind it as bad, because they just have to do two or three and it's a lot more feasible. It's something to do when we move on. It's not like they have a page. And so there's ways to, I think.
Right. Eating tomatoes is one thing. Swimming in them is different. Yeah. Looking at this lesson here, how many diagrams do they actually have? Well, they used them in their teaching, right? I just sort of did all that in one big fell swoop. You know, I was working the diagramming as I was teaching the lesson, right? I didn't segment those two. It would have been okay to do so. But anyway, they have three diagrams. Two of them already have the mainframe there for them, right? On the top of page 24, and that's all I'm seeing. By the way, there is one more page of this language lesson, and it is on spelling. So, not part of our subject here today.
So, what can you tell a student if they do ask you what is the point of diagramming?
What I will try to do is I'll try to explain that it's about visual aid. Do they like pictures? Well, diagrams are pictures of what we're supposed to learn.
I don't let them off on it. Mm-hmm. I personally kind of enjoy diagramming right. When I was in school. But, you know, sometimes, for sure, if they ask it in a nice way,
yeah, of course.
You can tell them for sure.
Assuming that's a sincere question, it's kind of like, I'm just thinking of this now, it's kind of like, do you have a mudroom at home? Do you have a place at home where everybody hangs their coats? Well, most families do, right? Well, this is the way we organize things. Do you just want a pile of coats? Do you want this language lesson is actually, the study of language is hard enough the way it is, but let's organize it, right? This presents it in an organized way. And just coat hangs here, the subject hangs here, the verb hangs here, the direct object hangs here, and so on. There's an orderly way. And so that way we can identify things and we can actually move around and have a better life because of organization. That's the kind of thing I would probably, that's off the top of my head. Is there more answer to that question, anybody?
That's usually what I always tell us to make students like you say these kind of things. You know, and then they sort of laugh. And then I actually explain what it's for. And they just seem to get that. It's a way to organize. Yeah. I think that's the biggest argument for it. Organize is get in your head.
And I might ask, would you like if in our language classes, would you like if I would just stand up here and lecture and not use the board, or do you want me to use the board? Right? Well, they're going to probably say, do you want me to use the board? Well, then I have to have some way to use the board, because we're talking about concepts. Right? If we're going to talk about horses and I'm going to use the board, I'm going to have to draw a horse. Indulge me, please. Give me the privilege of drawing a horse. If you want a visual about a horse, I'm going to draw a horse. If you want a visual about direct objects, I'm going to give you a diagram. That's the idea.
I've told my students as well that when you go to learn a second language, if you don't understand the way English works, it's going to be super hard. So every language has subjects and verbs. They just have different words for them and are arranged differently.
That's true. It's true. If you have a systematic premise for the language that you know, it's a terrific launching pad into the unknown new language. Right? Another thing that I say sometimes, too, is occasionally, if I read a sentence and it doesn't read well, I will actually think a diagram. Now, I realize that probably the average population might not do that, and neither is it appealing to tell a fourth grader that someday, when you're big like me, you're going to think a diagram when you don't understand a sentence that you just read. Well, they're not going to read sentences in a few years because you're going to be out of school. Is their demeanor, right? So that might fall kind of flat. It is true. I do use diagramming for reading comprehension, right? Or at least be able to identify what the editor missed before it went to publication. Right, Angela? You've been there, done that. Yeah, she does some copy editing for the stuff that Christian Light prints. Right. Yes?
I found your thumb system interesting. And I'm thinking about some of the groups that Joe and I taught, and I think some of them would have done better at self-evaluating than others. Some aren't in tune enough with themselves to know whether they have it or they don't. So just a suggestion, you can always whip out scrap paper, or if you have a little mini whiteboards, have them just all do one, and you can look and see, do they know it or don't they? And then they don't have to be telling you
uh-huh.
their interpretation if they have it or not.
did you get that tip? If they each have their own whiteboard, and that is really neat, to the idea that then you can be seeing whether they have thumbs up. And I am so dependent on that student feedback, that for me, I would take that another step and say, all right, and then, oh, you can put your thumb up, and you can put your thumb up, and you can, after a while, when you need whiteboards anymore, they'd be able to self-evaluate. All right. But great, great suggestion. That's awesome. And students actually like that thing of having their dry erase marker. I've seen that done in math classes, too. Every student have their little, you can buy it at Walmart for the price of a frozen pizza, cheap one at that. You know, they're easy to get into, buying their own little individual thing on the bottom.
Or you can send them to the board. They like to get up and move around.
Yeah, okay, take them up to the board.
If there's room, yeah.
Yeah, but the downside of that is then their work is in front of everybody, and it may actually highlight the difference. But if they're in their own little bubble with their own little whiteboard, not thinking about, then.
I actually have them use their language arts books or math books, like sometimes just work a problem in there, like, you know, instead of, I don't have the whiteboards or those things for them.
There's enough space to do it.
And I tell them, don't worry about erasing, like, most people like to keep it erased, but no need for it.
Right.
I did like the idea of doing the thumbs ahead of time, because it kind of gives you a sense of how they're feeling about it, maybe. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's...
In other words, when they came in, I asked them right away. Right? And what I didn't really know if I was going to tell much I was going to teach this lesson. I was half hoping that everybody would just give a solid thumbs up. And I'd check to see whether they're in the right place, and they would demonstrate to me that they have the knowledge, and then I would have dismissed them and said, sorry folks, but we're working with too smart a group of students, we need some dummies now. I had that script already, but I didn't have to use it because I had thumbs sideways. Right. I think it's hot in here and I'm ready to go. Are you too?
One thing quick, I didn't want to distract away from the analysis,
sure.
But this is kind of revealing that we're not using the curriculum exactly the way it's intended. How do you count points for diagramming? Like, I know on your quizzes sometimes it'll be like 5 points for the diagram. You divide that five by what? You can almost go infinite ways with it.
Right, Brian, thanks so much for bringing that up. When you count points for diagramming, There's actually several features to that question that are really important to notice. The one is you better have a system, all right? And it's really, really good if your students can comprehend that system and know how to check, if you're checking in class especially, which is what I would be accustomed to, right? But that system may or may not be what CLE system is, okay? So they have this sentence diagram that says 5 points, and you don't know how they got 5 points. And I would just simply say, that's okay. You're going to have to grade either by the pre-counted method of grading quizzes for CLE, or else your way. Do not mix the two. You mix the two at your own peril, all right? And it will make problems, okay? Is it making sense? The way I did it is I would count points my way, the way that made sense to me. And the way that made sense to me is 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 2, 3, and so on. A point per word. And a point for here, all right? So that's actually, because you know what they can do? They can put one of these in here, but it should have been one of those. Or they can put a predicate adjective symbol in instead of a direct object to use the proper terms, right? So how are you gonna penalize for that if you didn't give a point for it? You're not gonna wanna be fair, don't you, right? So I give lots of points when we're doing grading diagrams. But then when you come to a quiz and it says 5 points, well, then you're gonna have to wing it. And you're intelligent enough people to figure out, are they 20% there? If they're 20% there, you take 4 off, right? Because it's only 1 point that they got. 1 out of 5 is 20, right? Percent. So you're just going to have to just sort of, you know, think a little bit and say, well, I think that they earned 4 points on this one, so we put -1, right? And if that's not making sense to you, please meet me outside after this session or meet with your fellow school teachers. Right. If you're going to be putting any grade on daily work or quizzes or tests, it has to be statistically accurate. All right, it must be. Otherwise, go throw spaghetti against a wall. At least you're doing something. You know. Is that the second bell? Okay, what else? I'll keep you till the second bell.
Perhaps a little change of subject, but I'm wanting to some of our teacher in the history of our school started. So obviously you have the straight line for the direct object, the slanted line for the predicate noun.
The complements.
And then the same line for a predicate adjective. One teacher started getting them to make a slanted, wiggly line for a predicate adjective just so that they know the difference and that you can tell whether they're getting the difference between the predicate noun and predicate adjective, and seems to be working well.
Okay, that'll work. So this, in this case, we have a predicate nominative indicated because the line itself is straight. In this case, if I'm understanding right, we have a predicate adjective because the line is wiggly.
Exactly. I use that system.
And if you use that as a system.
The key.
All right.
Do that with certain squiggles for predicate adjective. Some people's straight lines are pretty straightforward.
We're obviously into the realm of teacher discretion here.
I'm not trying to match the system, but that would be a nice way to know whether or not they got. I think I don't make a big deal about that because there's plenty of time that they have to label it.
That's true.
In sentences, and so you should pick up there.
What are these we call which one? That or this?
Complements.
It's the bottom one because it completes. Something isn't spelled right there, but you get the idea. Like is that right?
That's right.
Oh, okay, that's right. Yeah, a complement completes, right? And you say it the same way so far as I know, right? We give compliments and we have compliments, right?
You said something interesting, Johnny. You said concrete. And
yeah, concrete.
Yeah, you got me there. I never do. So I just had fun with the extra concrete.
Concrete. Yeah, there's something nice and solid and organic about
that. I should start doing that, I guess.
Yeah, maybe you don't have to as a middle grade teacher. But the other thing is I researched that, and for the very first time in my life, the dictionary betrayed me. No, about that word. For the very first time in my life, the dictionary betrayed me, and that it says that is old English. So am I old or what? Right? So in other words, maybe we aren't that thing that I was saying earlier about we can't influence language, we can't change it. Maybe we actually can change it. All right, because language does change and does evolve, and after a while, what applied to you in school as concrete isn't so concrete anymore. Right? You're excused. Thanks for coming.